Joshua chapter 5, verse 1. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. Now, keep in mind where we are. The nation of Israel had been traveling for 40 years. They paused on the east side of the Jordan. God spoke to them about crossing over, and he said, as soon as the priests, I want the priests to carry the ark into the water, as soon as their feet touch the water, the waters of the Jordan will cease, and the ground will become dry, and the children of Israel will cross over on dry ground. They did that. They took the step of faith. They crossed over. The entire nation, some 2 million plus people, crossed over on dry land. They set up their pillars, their markers to remember the event, and now they're on the opposite side of the Jordan. Well, this is not done in a corner. It's not like you can hide 2 million people somewhere. So the enemies, the enemies of God, the inhabitants of the land, heathens is what they were, these heathens and pagans are watching all of this happen. And they're thinking, well, we've got some time because they're up against the Jordan. They can't cross the Jordan. And suddenly, as their spies are looking through their binoculars, they see the Jordan River part, and they cross over on dry land. And they're thinking, oh, my word, this is a miracle, because it took a while for 2 million people to cross over on dry land. And so they're recognizing this as something supernatural. Something miraculous, and what happens is their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. Now, we talked about this last week, and we looked at Exodus chapter 15, where in the song of Moses, he predicted in that song, he taught the children of Israel to sing about it, that the people's hearts would melt in fear and that they would tremble and that it was the arm of the Lord that would bring victory. We must never forget where victory comes from. We must never forget it. The point is, as we're looking here, and what I'm trying to say is, obviously, God has a way of taking control of a situation. He takes control of a situation. He's able to make things happen according to his will, and he's not moved by the will of man. He's not influenced by the will of man. And so here come these people. They walk across the Jordan. And what happens? God sends a wind of fear in the hearts of these people. And they're melting. Their hearts are melting because there was no spirit in them any longer. Why? Because of the children of Israel. Were they afraid of the children of Israel? Not really. I mean, yeah, they thought it was the children of Israel. They were pagan worshipers. And so it's possible that they thought that there was something magical going on, something weird was happening. But it was the Lord. They mentioned in here, it mentions here in the first verse, they heard that the Lord had dried up the waters. So they know that their God, the God of Israel, is much more powerful than any of the gods that these people had worshipped. This God works. It's a lesson for us to take to the bank as well. Our God works. He lives. That's why he works. The other gods were gods fashioned by their own hands, invented by their own imagination. So they couldn't work the way the living God of Israel worked. And so there was power there. And that's why these people melted. Their hearts melted in fear. In verse 2, at that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourselves. And now you're thinking, we're going to battle, and you're making knives out of stones, and that's what we're going to use to attack these people? We'll get you with our little flint knife. And I can imagine them, and Joshua's going, well, what are we going to do with knives? And Joshua's thinking, these are not for the enemy. They're for you. Make flint knives for yourselves and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Now, this makes absolutely no sense at all. They are now in enemy territory. They've got the enemy all around them and the Jordan River behind them. Now, they can probably say, let's go back and try and get the river to part again. But that probably wasn't going to happen. Now they're in the promised land, and God gives the command for the entire army, the entire male population of Israel, to be circumcised. This is not a pleasant experience. It is extremely painful. You remember a story, in fact, Genesis 34. In Genesis 34, there was the story where Dinah was raped. The daughter of Jacob was raped, you remember? And the brothers wanted to get even with them, but the guy that raped her really loved her, and he wanted to really take her and become her husband. And so they made a deal, Simeon and Levi, and they made a deal with these Hivites, and they said, sure, no problem, yeah, you can marry, but before you can do that, we want your entire population of men to become circumcised. It's really kind of a funny story. I shouldn't be so happy about it, but when you read about it in Genesis 34, they said, you guys go ahead and get circumcised, and afterwards we'll have a wedding. And so they went out, and in verse 24 of chapter 34, all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor and Shechem, his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. That's a dirty trick. In fact, God wasn't too happy about this because it was kind of a really dirty trick, and God doesn't like dirty tricks. But this is precisely what God is doing with them now. Is this a dirty trick? Obviously not. We know it's not. But here is this commander, this guy Joshua, the commander in chief. He's the leader of the people of Israel. And God is asking him to purposely handicap his army. Purposefully. But God, the enemy, they're right there. I can see their camp. It's right over there. They've lined the city. They've surrounded Jericho. They're setting up a wall of defense. They could attack us at any moment. In fact, we know that they're in this camp now on the west side of the Jordan for at least 2 weeks. It's very difficult to be inconspicuous for 2 weeks with 2 million people. But nonetheless, God is saying, I want everyone to put down their swords, put down their spears, and I want you to get circumcised. So make yourself some flint stones, flint knives out of stone, and we're going to take care of business. And Joshua made the flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the Hill of the Foreskins. That's not a place anyone should want to visit. But apparently there is a place they call the Hill of the Foreskins. And it's not a vacation place, probably, but... And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the wilderness on the way, as they came out of Egypt, had not been circumcised, for the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed or destroyed, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers that he would give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So the command was for the people, for the men, to become circumcised. And the reason was because they'd wandered in the wilderness so long that they basically let the practice die. Now, the circumcision was important because it was the symbol of God's covenant with his people. Abraham was the first one to become circumcised, and he circumcised his son, and he circumcised all of his descendants after that. All of the Jewish men were circumcised as the symbol of becoming the people of God. There is spiritual significance of this circumcision, but circumcision in itself was an actual physical act, the cutting away of the flesh. But it, of course, applies to the spiritual life of the Christian in particular, in the cutting away of the flesh as well, only we're talking in a spiritual way. In fact, in Scripture, there are several places that speak about this in light of a spiritual practice. In Romans chapter 2, Paul talks about it. For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law. We don't keep the law, but there is a circumcision that applies. In Romans 2, verse 27, and will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you, who even with your written code and circumcision are a transgressor of the law? For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly. Remember, the circumcision is the sign of the Jew. This meant you were one of the men of God, the people of God. But he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, just because you have the symbol of circumcision. Nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. So God, Paul is giving us the clarity of circumcision. It's not about the physical thing that you've done to yourself. It's not about something outward. He goes on and he said, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter or the literal practice of circumcision, whose praise is not from men but from God. In other words, if you're circumcised, Paul the Apostle said in Philippians, he was bragging about himself. He said, I was circumcised the eighth day, as if that was a rite of passage. And they put so much emphasis on the fact that they had done something physically to themselves, as if that was now the right of access to God or permission to be called the people of God. Now this becomes a problem, because God used this act of circumcision as a symbol of the covenant, not the covenant itself. It was only the symbol of the covenant. In the same way, God is saying, it's about the heart. So many of us come in here and we put all of our faith, or we rest our hope upon the fact that we were once baptized. In fact, some people have such a strong opinion about baptism that they believe if you've not been baptized with water, you can't enter into heaven. Because baptism, which Paul tells us and Peter tells us, is merely just something outward. It is just getting wet, but it symbolizes something else. And we place the emphasis on the shadow rather than on that which casts the shadow. Paul in another place talks about that. It is just the shadow of things to come, which is Christ. And so when we're talking about circumcision, when we're talking about baptism, we talk about these things, they relate to something inward. And we as humans are so conditioned to touch, to see, to feel, that we rely on the things that we can do with our hands. And unfortunately, it's about faith, which is actually easier than the things we do with our hands, the things that we do with our flesh. God is concerned with that which is inward, not that which is on the outside. And that's what Paul is telling us here. He tells us again in Philippians chapter 3, in the same context or the same thought of circumcision here. And he says, finally, brethren, rejoice in the Lord. This is chapter 3 of Philippians. Rejoice in the Lord. For me to write the same things to you is not tedious or bothersome, but for you it is safe. It's not any trouble for me to repeat myself. It's safe that I tell you these things just in case you didn't get it the first time. And then he warns, he said, beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, and beware of the mutilation. And this is all in context of those who came into the church as Christians under the law. And they came into the church and said, as Christians, you now need to be circumcised. So what they've done is they've taken the message of faith and added something to it. They added a physical thing, a work, an activity that in some way would become more important to you than your faith. Something that causes us to rely upon the activity more than resting in faith. This is a serious problem for the Christian church. We have this problem today. We put our faith in church membership. We had someone recently sent me a letter anonymously, which I don't usually pay attention to anonymous letters, and I will never respond to an anonymous letter ever in my life. If it was paper, I would have tossed it, but it was an email. This was more of a complaint in that she felt we don't have church membership, and that was a problem for her. We do have church membership, but not the way she was used to. In many churches, what happens is if you want to become a member, someone must sponsor you, or someone has to know you for a while, counsel with you, find out about you, and then they, in a sense, present you before the church meeting to say they want to become an official member, and then we put you on the roll, and then we expect you to send us money. We don't do that. No, it's about the membership. We don't do church membership in that way. We believe that church membership means that you feel as if this is your home. This is where you belong. This is where God wants you to be. And you prove that membership not by anything else except that you're here. And if you're here, we assume that you like us. And eventually we'll get to like you. And that's a good thing. That's where church membership should be, in that you feel a part of this place. And you'll prove it, secondly, in that you will give of your money without us having to beg you, ask you, or twist your arm to do it. Because that's when a person feels at home, when they're actually contributing to the needs of the ministry. They see what's going on. Others will say, well, I don't have a lot of money, but I can sure help the kids, and I'll work in the back with the kids, or I may not be able to help with the kids, but I can clean things, or I may not be able to clean things, but I can sing, or I can do this, or I can do that. You've become a part now. That's what church membership is about. But some people, they feel, I've joined the church, now I can go to heaven. Please understand it, they're two different things. You can join the church, but that doesn't guarantee you're going to heaven, because it has nothing to do with some outward rite of acceptance. It has everything to do with a heart that has been converted by Jesus Christ. And Paul's talking about this. Beware of dogs who are trying to teach you to put your faith in something other than your faith in Christ. And beware of these evil workers who are part of this mutilation. They're mutilating the faith. They're mutilating it, they're diluting it, they're perverting it, they're twisting it. He said, for we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit, rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh. No confidence in it. And then he goes on and he says, though I also may have confidence in the flesh, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day. I was of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. Concerning the law, I was a Pharisee. And he goes on and talks about his story of how perfect he was in the flesh, by the religious standard, by everything that would, he would have been the perfect church member in one of these churches that believes, I'm going to sponsor this fella Paul to be a part of our church. Well, what are his credentials? Well, he was circumcised the eighth day, stock of Israel, tribe of Benjamin, Hebrew of Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee. And talk about zeal. He persecuted the church. This guy is hot stuff. He should be accepted. And all of the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, or the church council would say, yeah, I think we can use a fella like that. How much money do you make? We'd like to see your financial statement before we actually accept your membership. But Paul the Apostle said, all these things I thought were so important, he said, what things were gained to me, these I have counted as loss for Christ. I give it all up, just that I might know Christ, that I might know Jesus Christ. This becomes now the circumcision of the heart, the circumcision of the Spirit. And he talks about it in another place in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 11. In him you were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, buried with him in baptism. Now comes that symbolism. You see the symbolism, the circumcision, the baptism, buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. And so this work of circumcision in the Christian's life is a spiritual work. It's something that God does when we enter into the new life, when we enter into this new experience with Christ. It is a spiritual work that God desires to do in our hearts through Jesus Christ. It is not a physical surgery. It is a spiritual surgery, a cutting away of the flesh, a dying to the self. A sweet lady called me today, and she was talking about, she was feeling a little down, feeling a little depressed. She doesn't come to our church, doesn't even live in her. I don't even know where she lives. I don't know how she got my number or why she called. I said, "Do you live here in Vineland?" She said, "Vineland, where's that?" She didn't even know where we were. "How did you get my number?" And I was talking to her and I was sharing with her. She said, "I feel so lonely. I feel like I'm helpless. I have no reason to go on living." I said, "Do you belong to a church somewhere?" She said, "Well, yeah, I go every now and then." I encourage her to get plugged into the church, to be a part of it, to get to know some of the saints, to grow in the Word, to grow in the Lord. I talked to the woman about stepping out and being a part of a community of believers that she would be able to grow in. And I said, "More than that, if you really want to help with your depression," I said, "start serving in a church. Help other people." She said, "Why would I do that?" Because I said, "The more you help other people, the less you think of yourself." And that's a real problem with us, because if you think about depression, so very often it is an overemphasis of the self. We're thinking so much about ourselves. We get so trapped in ourselves. And when you start serving other people, helping other people, it helps in getting rid of the depression. It doesn't cure all of it, but it helps to some degree. You don't sense the loneliness anymore. You don't sense, you know, the need, the lack, or whatever it is that you may be going through. I said, "Try focusing on other people." She said, "You know, I really appreciate that. But every time I hear that, I start hearing those words that people used to tell me." I said, "What words are those?" She said, "You know, die to self." I said, "Well, those aren't words of people. Those are the words of Jesus." He said, "If any man would come after me, he must die to self," or he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. I said, that was the teaching of Jesus. You're supposed to put yourself aside. And in Philippians chapter 2, it talks about that we're supposed to have the mind of Christ, that let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And then he goes on to describe the servant, Jesus, the king, who became the servant. And just before that, when he talked about the mind of Christ, he said that we're supposed to place others ahead of ourselves. And this becomes the secret to overcoming depression when our depression seems to be focused upon ourselves. And like I said, not all depression, but the depression that is from our own feeling sorry for ourselves, the best cure for that is to start feeling sorry for other people and to start helping others and serving others. And I said, when we do that, that's dying to self. That's a denial of self. And she didn't want to hear that. But precisely, that is what we're talking about when we're talking about the circumcised life. The spiritual life is entering in now. Why now? They just entered into the promised land. They just crossed over the Jordan. And as we cross over the Jordan, the crossing over the Jordan is like a symbol of being baptized into Christ and being placed into this new environment, the promised life or the abundant life. And that's the beginning. This is at the beginning. And it requires the circumcised life, spiritually speaking, the spiritual operation, the spiritual surgery, as opposed to anything physical. And now we come into this life where we recognize, as Paul did in Romans chapter 8, that there is a life after the spirit and a life after the flesh. And these two lives are combating and competing with each other. And Paul acknowledged the struggle that we have. And it is a constant decision on our part to recognize our circumcision to Christ and to recognize the fact that I don't want to live to the flesh anymore. I want to live in the Spirit. I want to live for God. I want to be joined to Him. And I no longer want this life for myself. And so this becomes now the choice. I imagine there were some men who said, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do it. And I can imagine Joshua looking at the man in the eye and saying, if you do not do this, you cannot live in the promised land. If you do not do this, you'll not be able to experience all the blessings that await us over there. And that's the problem with the Christian. The circumcised life is the life that is dying to the flesh. And if we will not die to the flesh, we will never enjoy the abundant life of promise through Jesus Christ. We can't do it. We're living caught in between two worlds. The life of Egypt and the life of promise were caught between two worlds and were miserable. When Jesus would want us to have more, so he said, make these stones and circumcise the men because we're starting fresh. This is the new life. This is the beginning of the new life. And the reason is because you walked in disobedience. The reason you walked in the wilderness for 40 years is because when we had the chance to be in the promised land, they came back and by doubt and fear, they turned away from the promise of God. So now we have to be cleaned of all of that. So all the men of war had to be killed in the wilderness along the way. Verse 5, all the people who came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. You see the picture here. Egypt is always a symbol of the world. The wilderness is a symbol of our wanderings apart from Christ. But then we come to the Jordan, and that is the invitation to the new life. Come in. Take the step of faith and cross over. Take the step of faith and cross over. And when you get to the other side, be ready to die to self. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up the cross. And that implies a bit of suffering. Because that's how we follow Christ. Don't buy into the notion that if you're a Christian, you no longer suffer. If you're a Christian, you no longer know pain. You no longer know illness. That's all a bunch of bunk. None of that's real. None of that is proven scripturally. It's not possible. All of us will know all of those things. That's what the Apostle Paul went on to say in Philippians chapter 3, that I might know Christ and the fellowship of his suffering. All of that is part of the Christian life. And so we move on in the invitation. Come across the Jordan. Come into the new life. And the new life starts off with circumcision, pain, suffering. And all of these men laying around, we know that they're here at least 2 weeks having to go through this whole thing, having to experience this pain, having to experience this, yet thinking all along, you're kidding me, Joshua. He goes on in verse 7. Then Joshua circumcised their sons whom he raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. Now imagine as he's telling these guys, all right, everyone, all right, put your stuff down. Guys, drop your drawers. Well, what are you talking about, Joshua? Well, the Lord just said this is what we got to do now. You know, all your fathers, they were all circumcised. You guys aren't. We can't go any further until this thing is done. Now drop them. Next. And they all walked along. Oh, I can imagine they're all itching. We're in the promised land. They got their weapons and they're ready to go. And it's not going to work that way. Instead, it says there, verse 8, so it was when they had finished circumcising all the people that they stayed in their places in the camp until they were healed. It doesn't make sense. In order for them to advance into the promised land, they had to first be hurt. They had to first experience something very painful, and they couldn't advance until they were healed. I'm telling you, I experienced this in the Christian life. We have to. You have to know this is true. If you've ever really seriously began to walk with the Lord, you know that you cannot advance without first experiencing some kind of suffering of the Lord. And it comes to us in this way. You've heard the saying, no pain, no gain. Well, that's not just a saying. In many ways of life, in many parts of life, it is a reality. And in particular, in the spiritual life, it is a reality. Because when we die to self, circumcision, it hurts. Because we love the comfortable life. We love a life, and I don't want to be put out. I don't want to be uncomfortable. I just want everything to move smoothly. And don't rock my boat. Don't rock my world. Just let everything go smoothly. You know that saying, life's a beach. Let me just lay on the beach. Let the sun shine all the time. You know, but as they say also, the sun shining all the time does not bring the rain, and we need the rain. I mean, think about it. They're in such a vulnerable position. But this is so that we will come to a place where we have to trust God. Boy, that's hard for us. It's so hard for us because we're so capable. We know this world. We're part of it. We know how the world works. We know how it functions. I can do just fine, thank you, in this world. But God purposely sometimes will handicap us so that we'll be stronger. Does that make any sense at all? No. But look at Jacob. He brings Jacob to a place of suffering. in the wilderness. Remember? He ran into God. He ran into the angel of the Lord. And there, the angel of the Lord was dressed up as a wrestler. And he took him down. And they started to go at it. They started to go at it until the break of dawn. And suddenly the angel of the Lord touched Jacob's hip. And it tells us after the story that he continued to walk with a limp the rest of his life. What does that mean? That wrestling match brought pain into his life, but the man was changed forever. It marked him forever, and he always walked with a limp, which means he always remembered that relationship, that meeting, that chance meeting he had with the angel of God who, poof, disappeared out of nowhere. When we experience pain that is brought about by God, such pain only produces good things in our lives. And that's where he brings us in this place, and he says, I want you guys to be circumcised. What? Trust me, do it. And we have to come to that place to become vulnerable, willing to be in a vulnerable position so that God will do mighty things through our lives. Then the Lord said to Joshua, verse 9, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. What reproach of Egypt are we talking about? Yes, it was that reproach of disobedience that as they came out of this horrible place, the reproach of Egypt. Remember, Moses and God were discussing this problem of the disobedience of Israel. And God, a couple of times, wanted to destroy Israel. And Moses stepped up and said, look, let's not do this. Why? Because the people of Egypt will speak poorly about us. They'll speak poorly about you. We become a reproach because we were brought out to the wilderness and all of us died. It sounds silly. It sounds foolish. Our disobedience brought this upon us is what God is reminding them. It was your disobedience. This is a reproach. And therefore, they called this place Gilgal, or rolled away, or rolling. Now, the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month, at twilight on the plains of Jericho. Now remember, there's the Passover meal, and right after Passover is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That's a whole week. So they're in no hurry. They're in no rush. At this point, they're about to face battle, but before they could face the battle, before they would want to face the battle, they're waiting on the Lord. They're just waiting for God to say go. All these guys are no doubt eager to go, but the Lord is putting them on ice, holding them back. Just take it easy. There's no rush. I want to go. Oh, as a young person, I always wanted to go. Always wanted to rush around. And I often made a lot of mistakes because I would just do things because I could. I had the energy. Fortunately, when we get older, we lose the energy. We don't run around as much. The impetuous youth, we say. But they wanted to run, and God is holding them back. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. And the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. Now, the manna was, of course, a 40-year miracle. It was a miracle that lasted for 40 years. Every day, except for Saturday, the manna would appear for the people to gather and to eat it. It was angel food. It was not your ordinary run-of-the-mill food, but they also grumbled about the manna. Remember, that's what the word manna means. What is it? It was something they couldn't explain. It's nothing like anything they'd ever seen before. And it was a heavenly bread. It was something different, miraculous. But it was stopped as soon as they came into this experience of the promised land, which was the land of abundance. And so this type of miraculous provision was no longer needed. And it stopped on that day. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho, and he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? It's interesting. He's looking at Jericho, scoping out this massive walled city. knowing that somehow we got to get into that place. Somehow we're going to go and take that city. I have no idea. I mean, he's probably sitting there thinking, I've fought battles for Moses and for my people, and I don't know how we're going to get into this place. We know we've got some friends on the inside. We got Rahab and her family, but I mean, I don't know what kind of work they can do for us. There's really no way into it. And I can imagine him scoping out the scene there, checking it out. What are we going to do? How are we going to get in there? Suddenly, this man appears out of nowhere. A man, my Bible, the word man is in a capital M, stood opposite him with his sword drawn, and Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or are you for our adversaries?" And he said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And this is beautiful. It's wonderful. Up to this point, he'd heard the Lord's voice. Moses saw him in the burning bush. Moses was in the cleft of the rock, saw his hand cover the cleft of the rock. And when God passed by and the hand was removed, Moses saw the backside of God as he passed by. And Moses had all these wonderful experiences. But now, as Harry Truman once said about being the president, being the loneliest man in the world. And so often what happens is you get this position of authority and you find out that you're suddenly alone. But the Lord had already promised Joshua in chapter 1, I'll be with you. As I was with Moses, I'm going to be with you. And so now God appears. This is the angel of the Lord. This is Jesus. It's called a theophany, an appearance of God in the Old Testament. This is the revelation of Jesus Christ. To Abraham, he appeared as one thing. To Jacob, he appeared as the wrestler. And now to Joshua, he appears as a warrior. Now, this is your Jesus. This is my Jesus. How would you want him to show up? You know, here Joshua is sitting there, and he's kind of seeking the Lord, and he's looking out. He's going to battle. What does he show up in? Dressed like a baker? What does he show up dressed like? A warrior, a sword. I'm ready to do battle, but you need to know something here. And he says, "Who are you? Are you for us? Are you against us?" He said, "I'm the commander of the army of the Lord." And he falls down and worships him. We know it's Jesus because an angel of the Lord would have said, "Hey, don't worship me. This is Jesus." We know that because in the book of Revelation, John fell down in his face and he worshiped an angel and he said, "Get up. I too am a servant of God just like you." We don't worship each other. We worship God. And so here is this manifestation of Jesus who comes as a warrior with his sword drawn in his hand. Joshua gets the wrong impression. "You're going to kill me?" "No, I'm the commander of the army of the Lord." Oh, and he falls on his face in humble worship and begins to worship the Lord. Notice what he says too. "What does my Lord say to his servant?" What lesson do we learn from that sentence? I mean, Joshua is the commander of the army of Israel. He's the president of the United States of Israel. But he came to recognize in that moment he's only number two. He's a commander of nothing because the commander of the Lord's army was there. And that is so important that we understand this in every part of our personal and daily lives, that we want God to rule our every day, our every command, our every wish. You know, there really are three ways to do God's work. Three ways that we can do God's work. The first way is we can make a plan and we're going to strive to make that plan work no matter what. We're going to do everything in our power to stick to the plan, to make sure this plan gets worked out the way we want it to be worked. That's one way to do the Lord's work. Another way is to make a plan and then ask God to bless the plan. And ask God to give you all the power, all the strength, all the ability to be able to accomplish that plan. Or you can start with God and ask him, "What is your plan, Lord? Help me to accomplish that." See, there's no striving in that. All there is there is obedience. And God is going to show Joshua exactly what he wants him to do. Joshua doesn't need to know. He just needs to obey. That's the servant of the Lord. That's what we do. All we have to do is wait on the Lord, and God will show us. You say, "No, that's not possible." It is possible. The problem is we're impatient. We are impatient. We want it done now. We want it done this way, and I have to do it, and I have to do it right now. And when that occurs, what do you suppose happens? We strive. Inside, we're in turmoil. Inside, we're constantly trying to make this thing happen. I got to make it happen. It's got to be done. And I get anxious inside. I know. I lived that way. I lived that way. Still am tempted at times to become that way. I've learned to let things go. I've learned that nothing is that important on this earth. If it is, God will bring me up against the Jordan and part it if he has to. And I don't have to make it happen. Joshua walked his people up to the Jordan River, and he's looking at it going, how are we going to get across this thing? Joshua, just believe me. Do as I tell you to do. Take the priests, put the ark on their back, and they're going to step into that water. And as soon as they step on the water, I'll take it from there. Now, Joshua, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go across the river. Now that you're across the river, I want you to go and fix these knives made out of flint stone. All right, what are we going to do with them? I want you to circumcise the people. Whoa, that doesn't make sense. What kind of military sense is that? It's the most foolish thing I ever heard of. Joshua, just do it. And they did it. And there's no rush. But the enemy, they're going to attack us. They're going to come in. They're going to rush us. They're going to get us. Don't worry, Joshua. Just do it and relax. Oh, this is described in Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. Remember, he talked about that rest that's so elusive, that rest. We're always striving to enter into this rest. But the author of Hebrews taught us about this very thing. And he said, if you want to really enter that rest, cease. Stop from your own works. Stop trying to make it happen. Let God do it. Let it go. Step back. So here we find this servant of the Lord in humble worship, first of all. And then he talks about surrender. Lord, I'm your servant. What does my Lord say to his servant? Have you done that today? Lord, what would you have me to do? That's what the Apostle Paul did. Lord, what would you have me to do? And the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, here's this mighty soldier, standing there, probably as radiant and massive as possible with his sword drawn, take your shoes off. What? This just gets weirder. Take the sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Oh, he's standing in a pagan world. Perhaps all up and down that riverbank, they crossed already. Who knows how many false gods and idols. And I can imagine them as they're going through going, ew, this reminds me a lot of Egypt. This stuff is nasty stuff. I remember when we had this in our tent. Remember God got so angry with my parents because of something just like that. Do you remember it? And Joshua knows. He was already there and he's experiencing this thing. And God says, take your sandals off, Joshua, because you're standing on holy ground. No, he's thinking, no, it can't be holy ground. Everywhere I look is pagans. There's an altar over there. They probably sacrificed children on that altar right there. This is a filthy place. It's a filthy place. And God said, no, I'm here, Joshua. And when I'm here, it's holy. Wherever I am, it's holy. And wherever I am with you, it will be holy. And that's why whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. It'll be holy. It'll all become holy because God in you is holy. This is such a precious verse. I love this passage of Scripture. We see the strength of the Lord. And this is not a pansy. This is not a mamby-pamby here. This is Jesus Christ with his sword drawn. And it's the picture that we find in the book of Revelation. He's going to come. His name is called the Word of God. And he's going to come with his sword drawn. It's going to be the sword of his mouth. And he's going to come. His robe is going to be drenched with the blood of his enemies. Jesus. You know, the little kid that we found in the manger? This Jesus, the same one, he's a warrior, commander, the army of the Lord, commands his people because there's going to be a warfare. Chapter 6, we'll go into warfare. We'll do that next week. But you cannot go into the warfare until you've been prepared for that war, until you've died to self, denied yourself, and taken up your cross. Until you've met with Jesus on the riverbank, until you've actually seen him and received your instructions from him, worshiped him, and submitted to him as your Lord. Don't go into battle until you've done that, until you've recognized that wherever you are and he is, you're in the right. You're holy with the Lord Jesus Christ. There is such strength in that. And Joshua would come to know that there is no possible way for him to defeat Jericho unless God did it for him. And as we're going to see, the silly story of the defeat of Jericho, a kid's story, isn't it? No, it really happened. It really happened. In our visits to Israel, one of the places they take you is the region of Jericho. There are no walls standing there, only funny guys selling you camel rides.